My name's Sean, and I'm from Ireland. To cut a long story short, I used to take part in amateur boxing fights, hoping to break into the professional circuit. But to keep protein on my plate in between bouts, I used to work for a private security firm in my home city of Dublin. I thought it'd all be on the doors, like being a bouncer, but as it turned out, there was more to private security than throwing drunks out of bars. That was a lot of what the job consisted of, don't get me wrong. But every so often, we got a job that was a bit out of the ordinary. For example, I had to guard a place of worship at one point because some absolute tools were camped out trying to intimidate the people going in and out. We got hired to guard a nursery once too, if you can believe that, because some mental case had come around threatening the kids and the guardé couldn't get hold of them. But without a doubt, the most memorable and most unusual event I was ever asked to provide security for was a funeral. But not just any funeral. It was for the boss of one of Dublin's biggest crime families. I'm not joking. This is back in 1991, when I was just 23, and by that time, I'd gotten used to getting the occasional weird job. But when my boss told me that we were to guard a funeral one Friday morning in September, I couldn't help but ask him for more details. It wasn't just me either. Everyone had their questions about it. Then, when our boss filled us in, we could barely believe our eyes. I doubt anyone listening to this would recognize the name, but if you were alive in Dublin around then, and I said, the Fitzies, then you're definitely going to know who I'm talking about. Anyway, Big Fitz had kicked the bucket, as you know, and he was going in the ground that Friday morning, and since the family was quite easily the wildest in all of Ireland, the big man's funeral needed many security guards. I believed it, too. A family that mental and violent, with all that booze and grief in them, it'd probably look like a five-card Vegas fight night by the time the buffet opened up. At least, that was the joke we were all sharing at the time. We just didn't know how right we were. We were told we wouldn't be needed at the church service, only at the Fitz family home, since that's where the alcohol would start flowing properly. Then on the morning of the funeral, we arrived at around 11 at this big mansion on the outskirts of the city. I'd never seen anything like it in the flesh, only on the television maybe, but not up close. It was like someone's dream home, all castle on the outside with modern living on the inside. They even had a maid that showed us around the place before the family got back from the church service, and we had to put on our professional hats to keep the place secure. The first black Range Rovers began turning up outside around 11:30. And out came a steady stream of weeping older women supported by their sons and nephews. It looked a lot like any other funeral, I suppose, only this one had outfits some people's whole salaries might not be able to cover. There was more Gucci and Prada than an Italian fashion show, and I couldn't tell which reflected the sun's glare brighter, the fancy leather on their shoes or the fancy watches on their wrists. Don't ever tell me crime doesn't pay. The mood was very tense at first, as you can imagine it would be among a family full of violent gangsters, possibly even murderers. But aside from that very large aspect of the job, it was much like any other funeral for the first couple of hours. In fact, one of the hardest jobs I had in those first few hours was refusing all the drinks the Fitz family was offering. They were a wild bunch, but they grieved like any other Irish family, which meant that after all the teary-eyed tributes and hugs among the bereaved, the party started. By about 2 in the afternoon, spirits were high, music was thumping inside the house, and me and the lads were starting to wonder what we'd been worried about. We'd pictured some intra-family disagreements descending into mindless violence, but in reality, we were in more danger of getting hit on by drunk women in their 50s than being part of any sort of brawl. We had 4 more hours to keep guard, and these 4 hours seemed like they'd be some of the easiest we'd ever worked. But then, it happened. The home's back garden was massive, and I mean truly massive. There was a big lawn, a football pitch and tennis courts combo toward one side, then a big pond and a gazebo on the other. We had 4 fellas surrounding the house, myself included, then 2 inside, which we kept on cycling to give them a break from all the harassment at the hands of the menopausal cougars. I was round the front, talking to a fellow guard, when we both suddenly hear the lad round the back talking over his radio. Someone had started banging on the backyard fence, pretty hard too, and then the next thing, we hear him swear before all went quiet. We ran around back of the house to see what the issue was, and then arrived just in time to see a man wearing all black and a balaclava smash his way through the fence using a sledgehammer. He gave the fence one last bash to really open it up, and then in streamed about a dozen identically dressed fellas, all carrying the likes of baseball bats, hammers, and clubs. Aside from the odd kosh or pair of brass knuckles we were carrying on the sly, none of us were armed well enough to defend against an attack like that. So instead, we focused on getting everyone inside and securing the home's back doors behind us. But since one of those back doors was a big glass sliding one, you can imagine how well that went for us. The masked men simply smashed their way into the home as we were getting everyone either out the front or upstairs to safety. But that's where the second problem came in, because many of those inside didn't realize what was happening until it was too late. All they knew was that someone had turned up looking for a fight, so in their state of drunkenness, they were all well up for a scrap. They just didn't realize the attackers were armed until it was too late, but even then, that didn't deter many. And what followed was a bloodbath. The men of the Fritz family put up a brave and brief defense, but they were all blind drunk and had nothing but their fists. One or two of them managed to land a punch or two, one of which knocked an attacker clean out. But any time that happened, the gang of attackers would swarm, beat the defiant man till he was either screaming or silent, then they'd move on to the next. I suppose they did what they had to do in a way, making sure security had the space to evacuate all the women and kids to waiting cars or safe areas upstairs. But it was only a matter of minutes before the gang beat back any resistance and started making their way towards the stairs. At that point, it became a question of how to keep the gang of attackers from advancing up those steps. I was freaking out, thinking, there's no way we're going to be able to hold them off. But to my surprise, the Fitz family had already planned for such an event, in that they'd stocked their master bedroom with a couple of unconventional, but very effective defensive weapons. Big Fitz, before he died, had been quite the collector of martial antiquities, including a samurai sword, two Zulu short spears, and a broadsword said to have belonged to the King of Leinster. I didn't know this all the time, obviously. The first I saw them was when one of the grannies upstairs started handing them out to us. One minute it was Lord of the Dance, the next it was Lord of the Rings. I'd never held a spear before, but there's a first time for everything in life, I guess. And the gang of attackers had absolutely rampaged through the home by the time we formed that final line of defense on the stairs. There were unconscious and severely injured people lying all over the kitchen, including one of our security team, but the gang wanted more. Yet when they got to the stairs and saw what they were up against, they very understandably hesitated. I remember gripping the short spear, called an ikwa, and telling some balaclava-wearing scumbag that if he tried coming up the stairs, I was going to skewer him like a feckin' kebab. He looked just as shocked as I was to see a bloody Zulu short spear being pointed in his face, but that shock and awe worked majorly to our advantage, and no one fancied a piece of it. There's this standoff on the stairs with everyone screaming at each other. Then the next thing I know, the women and kids upstairs with us started throwing things down from the floor above at the gang of masked attackers. I'm talking stiletto heels, little marble statuettes, big glass ashtrays, anything heavy or jagged enough to do some damage started raining down onto the attackers below. I remember seeing this one big ashtray land on this fella's head, and he actually collapsed to the ground, even started shaking and twitching. His pals started screeching, trying to wake him up, and then trying to drag him out towards the back garden, but those missiles kept coming. I suppose that's what saved us in the end. Having us forming that line of defensive was one thing, but we were still outnumbered and outgunned, so to speak. One swing of that sledgehammer would have smashed my spear. I know the gang could have taken us if they wanted to, not without a couple of serious injuries, but they'd have been able to do it if they really, really wanted to. But it was those screaming harpies above and beside us that won the day. By the time the gang retreated to the back garden again, the home's hallway was just a mess of blood, broken glass, marble dust, and broken shoes. The gang had also started to smash things on their way out, probably as a final FU to the Fitzes. but that was nothing compared to the damage they'd done to the men of the family. Like I said before, we might have done a job in protecting the more vulnerable members of the family, but those that had tried to fight back had been subjected to what I can only describe as a bloodbath. There were broken legs, broken arms, broken ribs, and fractured skulls. People's teeth were smashed, their fingers were literally hanging off in places, and one guy's eye had popped out of the socket following a really severe skull fracture. We had to keep all the kids upstairs while the EMTs carried everyone outside. We could hide their eyes from the injuries, but trying to ensure they didn't hear the screams was basically impossible. They only died down when the small army of paramedics started pumping painkillers into the victims, but even then, what were screams became these terrible groans and moans as the wounded were ferried to waiting ambulances. The guard I had been there for a while by the time the wounded were all taken to hospital, and I have expected everyone to give them the cold shoulder. But even though some of these people had been involved in criminality all their lives, and their whole motto was basically, "Don't talk to the Gardai," they had zero problem telling them absolutely everything about the masked gang's attack. I suppose when it suits them, criminals use the Gardai as a weapon like any other, not just to punish their enemies, but to identify them in cases where they've concealed their faces during an attack. But why attack a funeral like that? And who in their right mind would target a funeral of all things? Well, as far as I know, the answer's a pretty simple one. The attackers were a rival criminal family the Fitzes had rubbed the wrong way one too many times, and the why is even simpler. Because they could. Our colleague that was wounded during the melee ended up needing about 30 stitches to put his head and face back together, and he never returned to work after that. I also heard something about the guy who was knocked unconscious with that big glass ashtray. He didn't report to the hospital straight away. He couldn't. But that meant the brain injury he'd received got worse and worse until finally he showed up at A&E begging for help because he kept having seizures. Apparently the doctors asked him how he hurt his head, but then instead of just making something up, he goes to tell them exactly what had happened. He says he and his pals raided the Fitz's property, where he'd gotten a bonk on the head and he didn't remember anything else. The doctors start doing brain scans, trying to work out the damage, then once they were done, the cops showed up and arrested him. His gang got him a lawyer, who instructed him not to say another word regarding who was present at the raid. Then in the end, this poor guy was the only one to go down for what had happened, and all because that brain injury meant that he couldn't think properly anymore. His fellow gang members let it happen too, because he was no use to them out in the streets anymore, and he had two choices, keep his mouth shut and do his time, or they'd have him killed in prison to keep him quiet for good. That wasn't strictly the end of the whole affair either, and after about 6 months of calm, some of these rival gangsters started turning up dead all over Dublin. Not all of them, mind you, just the ones that the Fitzes were sure had raided their house on the day of that funeral. And not long after the bodies started turning up, I handed in my notice. I came in to realize that some security firms, at least in Ireland, were Siamese twins with some of the country's crime families. There was just no separating them without at least one half dying a death. I asked my boss if that was the end of us working with families like the Fitzes, and he gave me an honest answer when he told me, no. We worked for whoever pays, and that was that. It's just that in our case, the people willing to pay the big bucks for security tended to need it for all the wrong reasons. I ended up signing on to a different firm later on, one that dealt almost exclusively in providing security guards to the likes of HMV and Tesco. The pay wasn't as good, obviously, but it was a much quieter life, and I got to focus on my boxing much more too, although my career never took off in the way that I'd hoped. That didn't bother me much, though. Because I got to settle down, live a quiet, peaceful life, and start a family, all without having to worry about masked thugs attacking me and mine when we were at our weakest. I was in the parachute regiment for just shy of 10 years before I was discharged on medical grounds. I was gutted at the time. But then once it sank in, I was pleasantly surprised by how many options I had available to me. I remember many years before, a friend's dad told me, All you'll be able to do when you leave the army is drive lorries and kill people. But he was wrong. I got offers from some big-name private military contractors almost straight away, who promised me good money once I'd passed their much less demanding medical exams. But I also got a few handy suggestions from some old paratrooper friends. One guy was over in the States consulting on TV shows, like teaching actors how to shoot and move like they'd been trained and all of that. And he said the hours were horrible, but the money was great, and I was seriously considering flying out to meet him. But then I spoke to another old friend of mine who had a very different but very interesting proposition. He was working in CPP, or Close Personal Protection, which is the fancy term for working as a bodyguard. He'd found a job with a high-profile London-based company who provided bodyguards to some of the world's biggest stars during domestic and sometimes overseas visits. In so many words, he got to travel around the globe with some of the world's biggest celebrities, living a life of absolute luxury outside of his working hours. Not every job was like that, of course. Even after just 18 months, he'd already been to the Maldives, Singapore, and St. Lucia twice. They fast-tracked ex-military guys thanks to their discipline, training, and expertise, so I already had a foot in the door. Then a couple of months later, during my first assignment, I was like a duck to water. It wasn't as big of a buzz as being a paratrooper, but it scratched a lot of the same itches in terms of executing plans, staying switched on, and putting on a show of force. It felt natural, I was good at it, and I've been doing it ever since. But I won't lie, at first it seemed like proper basic work compared to soldiering. Teenage girls might make a lot of noise, and this might come as a bit of a shock to some of you, but they're simply not as dangerous as the Taliban. And while the mega fans can be slippery and quite disturbing with some of their delusions, they don't mean the subject of their obsession any harm. They're also terrified when they see a load of ex-army bodyguards marching towards them, demanding they step back or vacate the area. So for a long time, I didn't feel very threatened by anybody. But that changed with this one job I worked, when I got a nasty lesson in the kinds of people I should be prepared to deal with. So for every high-profile job we did, there'd be an extensive risk mitigation meeting, and if we were providing services for a touring musical artist, we had to have those meetings on each individual stop of the tour. Each city brought a different landscape of risks, and while those risks took on many different forms, the most unpredictable, and therefore the most difficult to deal with, were the people. Like I said, the vast majority of fans who wanted to breach our security cordon were only hoping to meet their idols, and when we caught them, they'd inevitably just apologize and cooperate with us. One guy cried, thanked us for not beating him up, and then called his mom, asking her to pick him up from the venue. But unfortunately for us, they weren't all like that. So during those risk mitigation meetings, our bosses would often put together profiles of certain persons of interest. These mostly included the type of person mentioned above who, while irritating and unpredictable, were ultimately harmless. Every so often, though, you got a different breed of superfan, the kind of person whose obsession was about as far from amusing or endearing as it was possible to get. It was fairly obvious the fellow that I'm about to tell you about was dealing with some severe mental illness, and maybe he's gotten help for it and turned his life around, and I truly hope he has. But we'll just call him Walker. Walker the Stalker. So we're at the meeting, and one of our bosses brings up Walker the Stalker's PowerPoint profile, which includes his name, his picture, his criminal history, and a few screenshots of his blogs and social media pages. He seemed quite the character, with his numerous facial piercings and his bush of rainbow-colored curly hair. Someone joked that he looked like a clown, but there wasn't much to laugh at outside of his appearance. Walker was well and truly obsessed with the client we were guarding, and not even the kind obsessed where it's all worship and adoration. He was a very negative kind of obsession, as he seemed fixated on doing our client harm. Walker the Stalker seemed to think that our client was his wife. He also believed that her relationship with another prominent artist amounted to cheating, and for that, she deserved punishment, to use his words, not mine. I won't repeat any of the graphic stuff he said. It was disgusting, truly stomach-churning, and it's been so long that I'd never been able to quote any of it correctly anyway. But just take it from me. I'd seen and heard a thing or two during my time in the army, and the things this guy posted on his blog were truly some of the worst things I'd ever seen written. And that was before we got the credible threats he'd posted regarding our client's tour stopping in his home city. They were some of the most urgent threats to life I'd ever seen on the job, and I instantly understood why he was being considered our high priority. This guy had uploaded pictures of himself wearing what amounted to a ninja costume, along with the weapons he was planning on using to get to our client. He had pepper spray, a stun gun, a pair of gloves with steel knuckles, and about half a dozen knives of varying shapes and sizes. He also boasted about getting his hands on the building plans for the venue our client was performing at, which seriously threw a spanner in the works for us in terms of our security plans. If someone's going to hang around the stage entrance trying to get an autograph, that's one thing. But if some seriously determined individual is fixated on gaining access to a venue, it can be very difficult to stop them without the right amount of manpower. But in those kinds of cases, it doesn't hurt to call in the cavalry. I'm pretty certain this is the same in other countries too, but here in the UK, issuing credible threats of violence to a person is against the law. This meant we could contact the local police force, share our person of interest online threats with them, and more often than not, they'd nip any threat in the bud on our behalf. We couldn't do this on every occasion, not even when the threats were credible, but since we had our person of interest's name, address, and an idea of his criminal history, we were able to point the police right at him. And this meant that he was likely going to spend the night of our client's performance in a cell. They're not exactly the proudest moments of our career, just picking up the phone and calling the police instead of doing any work ourselves. But if it works, it works, so that's what we did. More often than not, within a few hours of making our complaint, we get a call back from the police saying that the person has been dealt with. Most of the time, that meant having a quiet chat with them and warning them that they could be arrested for harassment. Other times, the threats were so graphic that they'd be taken into custody and charged with malicious communication. But in this case, when we got our call back regarding Walker the Stalker, we were told he'd flown his coop. Police gained access to his property that afternoon after he failed to answer the door. Walker wasn't there, and his neighbors said they'd seen him leaving that morning wearing his all-black clothing and carrying a large sports bag. If that was true, there was a good chance Walker the Stalker was already in the vicinity of the venue and was simply waiting for the right time to strike. Hearing this sent me and my team into overdrive for a couple of hours. We scoured the surrounding area, performed a full sweep of the venue, and secured all the entrances and exits to ensure nothing had been disabled, damaged, or otherwise tampered with. I hope you're starting to understand what I mean when I say those stalker types could be a proper pain in the arse. All that work, just for one single person, and we still weren't 100% satisfied once we were finished. In the end, we had to just do our best, stick to our security plan, and remember our drills, and then just hope for the best. But then surprisingly, the entire evening went off without a hitch. We got the client to the venue, ensured a tertiary ring of security in addition to the venue's own staff and security, and then once all was said and done, we got her back to the hotel, safe and sound. Me and two other guys had agreed to do an all-nighter to keep the client's hotel floor secure. I'd been on since midday, but I fancied the overtime along with some of that fancy hotel room service for supper. The client and her crew's rooms were situated along a VIP corridor on one of the building's top floors. One man was posted on either side in a small landing area with a chair and a locked door. Then the third would patrol the corridor and the wider hotel to ensure everything was as it should be. Since the concert had come and gone without incident, we thought we'd probably be in for a quiet night, and for the most part, we were. But it only takes one hot minute for everything to change, and that night was no exception. It was around 2:30 in the morning when my colleague, who was patrolling the hotel's perimeter, gave us a call over the radio. He'd spotted a car parked in an industrial estate across the street from the hotel. He'd said he'd go and check it out and then report back on what he'd found. Then a few minutes later, he radioed us again saying that the car looked empty and it was kind of giving him bad vibes. Me and my colleague inside started getting a bit antsy, and I started to suspect our night wasn't going to be so quiet after all. Next, our colleague radioed to say that there was a lump in the back seat, covered in blankets, and it looked like a person was sleeping under them. I immediately start thinking that it's our person of interest, either hiding after spotting my colleague's approach, or getting a few hours of sleep before moving on the hotel in the pre-dawn hours. So, when my colleague starts walking away from the vehicle, I suggest just tapping on the glass to make sure it's not Walker the Stalker and just some overnight driver on a long journey getting a few hours of kip so they're safe for the drive again. And right as I suggest that, the lift dings open in front of me, and a member of hotel staff walks out pushing a trolley. I saw a younger man in his hotel uniform with close-cropped hair, so I waved him past as I listened intently to my earpiece, awaiting my colleague's response. The young man kind of nodded nervously, then carried on pushing what looked like a laundry trolley towards the VIP corridor. A second or two later, my colleague started telling us how he suddenly didn't think it was a person anymore. He didn't know what it was under those blankets, but it hadn't so much as twitched when he'd knocked as hard as he could on the rear passenger window. He was also so close that it didn't look so much like the shape of a sleeping person anymore, meaning the car wasn't occupied. It was empty. So right away, we're in a bad situation because we had an empty, unaccounted-for vehicle within what we called our primary ring of security. We had an unknown element in the area, meaning that we had to switch on and stay focused. Then right as I'm putting my game face on, I notice something about the trolley-pushing member of hotel staff in front of me. Naturally, having pushed his laundry trolley over to the door, he was now trying to access the VIP corridor using his keycard, only the keycard wasn't working. I wasn't too concerned at first. I know for myself that kind of tech isn't always reliable. But what I did notice was this young member of staff switched to a second keycard and then what looked like a third, all to have them rejected by the little scanner. I start watching him get more and more frustrated and more nervous before asking him if he needed any help. It wasn't a genuine offer, just something to make him turn and look at me, and then when he did, he looked scared out of his mind. I was just about to ask him if he was a wee bit starstruck at the idea of meeting a big celebrity. Again, not a genuine sentiment, just something to engage him so I'd get the measure of the man, and that's when I realized who it was. His hair was short, very short, but poorly shorn, almost like he'd done it to himself with very little experience. And then once I'd pieced that little detail together, I recognized his face. He'd cut his hair short, and he'd taken out his facial piercings too. But I recognized who it was. It was Walker the Stalker, in full hotel uniform, and he was standing right in front of me. In the UK, it is highly illegal for personal protection officers to carry any kind of lethal weapon. It's also very illegal for us to carry non-lethal options too, so carrying things like stun guns, pepper spray, or batons are going to land you with a criminal record. I'm sure a lot of you are going to be tearing your hair out at the mere description, asking, then how are you supposed to defend yourselves? Well, firstly, bulletproof and stab-proof vests are an option we regularly employ, and since we're not allowed to carry weapons, there's a heavy emphasis on martial arts training, particularly judo and jiu-jitsu. But there are certain products which exist in a kind of legal loophole, things that are specifically designed to circumvent the rather strict UK laws regarding self-defense. And one such item was the non-toxic dye spray that I had on a keychain in my pocket. It operates in an identical manner as pepper spray, but instead of deterring your attacker via a shower of stinging vapor, it basically involves spraying a non-toxic, fast-degrading paint in their eyes to temporarily blind them. I've used it once before, and it was just as effective as I thought it was going to be. But like a lot of the stuff like that, it's only effective when it works, and whether or not it works depends on who you're using it on, as well as the situation at hand. For example, when I realized it was Walker the Stalker in front of me, having shaved his head and removed his piercings, I told him to stop what he was doing, step back into the lift, and leave before I call the police. But Walker the Stalker didn't like that idea, and he attempted to argue his case with a zombie knife he'd clearly hidden in the laundry trolley he'd somehow acquired. I don't know if the term's made it over to the United States yet or anywhere else, but here in the UK, the term zombie knife refers to large knives or miniature machetes, that are often curved, spiked, or otherwise unconventionally shaped. Walker the Stalker produces one, charges me with it, but I'm ready to deploy my dye spray, and when I did, I unleashed a powerful stream of it right into his angry little face. The reaction was instant. He was blinded, which he clearly found unpleasant, but it only made him angrier. On top of that, he knew exactly where I was too, so as he recommenced his charge and I tried to get out of the way, the landing proved too narrow and he connected with a swing of his knife. If it wasn't for my stab vest, I would 100% be a dead man right now, because the blade connected with my chest, but slid down the fabric of the vest after cutting through my shirt. But what made me doubly fortunate was that Walker's first strike had thrown him completely off balance. This gave me an ample opportunity to subdue him, but Walker was slippery. He managed to twist out of the hold I was trying to put him in and bring up that zombie knife again. Under any other circumstances, it wouldn't have been an issue because I had him from the back, but the curved section of the blade was long enough to reach back and cut into my forehead. Another swing, and he could have had my eye out, so I shoved him forward, backed away, then keyed the emergency button on my radio to silently call in all available assistance. I had a colleague come running down from the opposite end of the hallway, which in turn alerted the light sleepers on the VIP corridor that something was going on. He came running like a bat out of hell, and all the corridor behind him started to fill up with frightened VIPs. But there were a few grim seconds there where I was alone with a very blind, but still very dangerous stalker. He was screaming and waving the zombie knife around, but the fact that he was temporarily blinded meant that he kept swinging at nothing, and then retreating from nothing and again. This was obviously very good for me, but his erratic swings in the shape of the knife meant rushing him would be a huge risk without someone else present. Luckily, my colleague was at my side in mere seconds, and after hurling a potted plant at the blinded walker, we were able to tackle and subdue him while isolating the arm that he was carrying the blade with. Hotel security was there to assist within minutes, and the police were there a short while after that. Walker the Stalker was taken into custody, and while everyone was a bit shaken, it all amounted to a job well done. But what's never been properly explained to any of us was how he got his hands on that hotel uniform, as well as the key cards he was using to access various spaces. Walker didn't talk to the police, he didn't enter a plea at his trial either, and he refused to leave his cell to attend his sentencing hearing. He never said a single word to anyone about anything, and the only clues to his motivations were the things he'd posted online. Obviously, he put a lot of time and effort into his little plan. Touring artists post their dates 18 months in advance sometimes, giving creeps like Walker plenty of time to craft their little schemes. But how he'd managed to find the exact hotel our client was staying in was tradecraft even professionals like me could admire, even if we did so begrudgingly. And if his keycard scheme had worked, God knows how he managed to program them, he might have made it all the way to a VIP room completely unchecked. Because again, radically changing his appearance prior to striking was a deviously impressive bit of deception. I feel like this is best ended by circling back to my point about how just one single person can cause an awful lot of trouble for an awful lot of people. I suppose I should take a bit of comfort in that, because if that wasn't the case, people like me would be out of a job. But it still sends shivers down my spine, knowing there's many more out there, just like Walker, and not all of them are going to fail. Back in 1999, I was a scrappy 18-year-old kid from rural Ontario, and since I didn't like the idea of working at a mill or driving a plow, I decided to join the army. Enlisting wasn't too complicated back then, but it wasn't a cakewalk either. I walked into the recruitment center in Kingston, and then a couple of corporals asked about my fitness, my grades, and why I wanted to join. I gave them some stock answer about wanting to serve my country, but really, I just wanted to get the hell away from Hanover. 2 years later, I was a private with Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, stationed in Edmonton. It was early autumn, and I was in the mess hall scarfing down a late breakfast after a run when someone yelled out to crank up the volume on the TV. The screen showed the Twin Towers in New York. Smoke was pouring out of a hole in one of them, then a few minutes later, the second plane hit. The room went dead quiet. Dudes forgot that they were even eating. Then we watched, totally stunned, as the towers collapsed and ash-covered people ran through ash-covered streets. Over the next few hours, the news kept replaying the planes, the fire, and the chaos, and the mess hall filled up with guys just glued to the TV. We all knew it, even before the CO started briefing us. War was coming, and it was going to be bad. The world we'd trained for, all the peacekeeping missions and Cold War cleanup, was gone. We were headed to Afghanistan, and it wasn't going to be some UN mission handing out blankets either. It was going to be ugly, and we'd be in the thick of it. I feel this mix of dread and excitement, like history was about to drop the puck for us. But in 2002, the itch to do more than patrol and train got me thinking about JTF2, Canadian Special Operations Forces, the real deal. If I wanted to guarantee a spot in frontline operations in Afghanistan, that was the ticket. Getting into JTF2 was the toughest thing I've ever done. I was in decent shape, but decent just didn't cut it with how brutal that selection process was. They dragged us out to the backwoods of Ontario for a month of hell. We got barely any sleep and were subjected to a constant mix of ruck marches or navigation drills in the dark. But the worst were the psych tests designed to mess with your head. The directing staff would scream at you, starve you, anything to push you towards quitting. I saw good soldiers, tough as nails, break down and walk away. I didn't crack, but I came close. After that came specialized training, close quarters combat, advanced weapons, parachuting, the works. It took a further year before I was badged in as a JTF2 operator, but when I was, it was the proudest moment of my entire life. By the time I deployed to Afghanistan in 2003, I felt ready for anything. We piled into a Hercules out of Trenton, with a cargo hold stuffed with gear and guys from JTF2. Then we all tried to catch a few hours of sleep to make the long-haul flight go faster. The plane droned on for what felt like forever, and we stopped to refuel somewhere in Europe before landing at Kabul International. When we stepped off the ramp, we saw mountains standing tall against the horizon and the city sprawled out in front of us in a cloud of dust. And then, and only then, did it actually feel real. Me and my unit ended up being based at Camp Julian near Kabul, a dusty compound ringed with HESCO barriers and razor wire. Inside, it was all tents, conexes, and the constant hum of generators. We needed those jennies too because the heat was brutal. It had to be like 40°C in the shade sometimes, and the dust got into everything. Your rifle, your nostrils, and other less mentionable places too. Afghanistan itself seemed like a kind of paradox to me. You had those beautiful mountains and green valleys and all that rich history, but they had nothing to show for it. Just blown-out villages and kids begging for pens. The people were tough. I mean, they had to be to survive decades of war, but many were kind and welcoming and would offer us chai or flatbread with glimmers of hope in their eyes, thinking that maybe this time things were going to be different. But as you might know, they weren't. As JTF2 operations were high tempo and high stakes, we weren't doing foot patrols or handing out aid. We were hunting bad guys, mainly Al-Qaeda, but sometimes Taliban too. Direct action missions were the core. We'd roll out in GMVs or on foot with NVGs moving silently through villages where barking dogs could blow your cover. Then we'd perform night raids on Al-Qaeda safe houses, kicking in doors, clearing rooms, and grabbing high-value targets like bomb makers or commanders. Other times we'd do recon, lying up in the hills for days watching insurgents through optics, then calling in airstrikes when the time was right. We'd also sometimes work with our counterparts in the SEALs and Delta, sharing intel or hitting compounds together. And every op was a gamble. We were up against IEDs, ambushes, or sometimes just bad intel that could turn a clean snatch into a fatal firefight. The adrenaline was addictive, but the weight of what we were doing wore us down and sometimes seemed like the more you tried to change Afghanistan, the more it only changed you instead. A few months after the coalition went into Iraq, so late 2003, My guys and I were hauled up at a compound on the outskirts of Kabul when we got news of a job. Our CO said that we'd be linking up with a CIA outfit called Task Force Saber 7 for a joint operation that involved hitting the suspected hideout of an Al-Qaeda bomb maker. We'd done these kinds of ops before. Snatch the target, grab the intel, in and out, and JTF-2 doesn't mess around, so I figured these CIA boys would be pros, just like the SEALs or Delta we'd run in with before. The name Task Force Saber 7 sounded legit, like something straight out of a Tom Clancy novel. So we geared up, checked our C-8s, and then rolled out expecting a tight operation. We met Saber 7 at a rendezvous point just outside the village in the early morning hours, but right away, something felt off. The task force wasn't what any of us had expected. Instead of a slick crew of American spooks, it was three Americans and a mob of 15 Afghans, all kitted out in mismatched gear like they'd raided one of Kabul's many weapons markets. The guy in charge, a loudmouth calling himself Jack, strutted around in sunglasses and a U.S. Army uniform and talked like he was auditioning for a Hollywood war movie. He threw around terms like HVT and Intel Stream with this kind of forced bravado, but we could see it for the performance it was, and the Afghans under him looked more like hired muscle than a disciplined unit. They were twitchy, gripping their AKs like they were just itching to use them, so I had a bad feeling about them from the get-go. Some of us figured that they might prove us wrong, work their magic, and bag their guy, but the op was a crapshow from the start. We were supposed to sweep the village methodically, house by house, looking for bomb-making materials, things like wires, chemicals, the usual signatures. But Jack and his boys treated it like a free-for-all. He barked orders at his Afghans in a kind of pigeon Persian, and then they stormed into mud-walled homes, kicking over furniture while screaming at families. We'd been trained to keep civilians calm, to de-escalate high-tension situations, but Jack's unit was doing the opposite. I saw one of his guys smash an old man's face with a rifle butt for no reason other than he was slow to do as commanded. And stuff like that is considered a serious infraction. But Jack didn't blink. He just kept yelling about bombs, the Taliban, and bin Laden. It was chaos, and it was clear he didn't know how to run a proper search. There was no grid pattern, no coordination. He'd point at random houses, claiming SIGINT had marked them as hot. But when we checked, all we'd find were blankets and cooking pots. It honestly seemed like things couldn't get any worse, but then, somehow, they did. Jack's Afghans started dragging people out of their homes and then lining them up in the dirt. I heard screams from a house down the street, and when I got there, Edima's two American guys were beating a shopkeeper, demanding he confess to being Al-Qaeda. The guy didn't even speak English, but Jack was right there minutes later, egging them on, saying stuff like, "Break him. He knows where the bombs are." But there was no evidence, no bomb-making equipment, just a terrified old man begging and pleading in the dirt. I pulled my sergeant aside and said something about how the task force didn't seem like they knew what they were doing. He nodded, tight-lipped, but we had our orders. We kept moving, but I felt sick, like we were complicit just by being there. The raid eventually wrapped up, but we found nothing. No bomb maker, no explosives. All we'd done was tear that village apart. Then, as we were prepping to exfil, a couple of Edima's Afghans came over, grinning like they'd won a prize. One of them pulled out a cloth bundle and unwrapped it. Inside were dried, shriveled pieces of human flesh, fingers, ears, and other parts I couldn't identify. They said it was from a woman they'd caught, claiming she was Al-Qaeda or Taliban. And I wanted to puke. These weren't soldiers. These were murderers and butchers. My team stood there, stunned into silence, as the Afghans laughed and passed the bundle around like some trophy. I looked at Jack, half expecting him to shut it down, but he just smirked and said something about how that was part of their war, not ours. Back at base, my sergeant lost it. He got in Jack's face, calling him out for letting his men run wild and for letting them take body parts as trophies. But Jack just shrugged, cold as ice, and said something about how he was just helping them clean house. I've seen some cold mother effers in my time, but the way that Jack guy acted was next level. My sergeant stormed off, radioed our CO, and told him we were done with those Saber 7 clowns. We figured the CO would come down on us heavily since they were CIA, but he came back saying that he couldn't get a straight answer on who they were. He called an American officer in Kabul, who swore the CIA had no record of any Task Force Saber 7, and the Pentagon didn't know either. It was like Edema and his crew had materialized out of thin air. And we started quietly asking around trying to find out who the hell Jack really was, but nobody had any answers. Some of the American guys we worked with said that he'd been floating around Kabul since 2001, peddling fake Al-Qaeda videos and claiming he was hunting bin Laden. But it wasn't until mid-2004 that we started hearing whispers about what Jack was really up to. After that FUBAR raid with the so-called task force, we kept our distance from them. But then one day, the rumors started swirling. Jack wasn't some wannabe operator. He was running a private torture prison. The Afghan police raided his compound in July, and when the truth came out, it was worse than we could have ever imagined. He'd set up shop in a two-story house in Kabul, a nondescript place you'd walk past without a second glance. But inside, it was a living nightmare. They'd turn it into their own private black site, with zero oversight and no rules. They called it a mission to hunt Al-Qaeda, but in reality, it was more like something out of a cheap splatter movie. Jack Edema was arrested, and so were his two sidekicks. One guy, Brent Bennett, was a former paratrooper, but the other guy, Ed Carballo, was literally just a journalist, former CNN and National Geographic too, who attached himself to Edema's fake unit so he could see some action. And their scam was terrifying and simple. They'd grab Afghans off the street, just regular folks like shopkeepers, farmers, anyone they decided was a quote-unquote terrorist. Then they'd drag them back to their makeshift torture prison before interrogating them. Those that gave false confessions were then handed over to the Americans, most likely in exchange for some kind of bounty and continued military assistance. Eight guys were found when the cops busted in, some hanging from their feet, others bound and hooded, all of them beaten to hell. The place had makeshift cells, chains on the walls, with all the blood and feces everywhere, and I heard that it stunk to high hell. Edema claimed he was interrogating high-value targets for intel on bin Laden, but it was all bullcrap. Most of those poor guys were just locals caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. The Afghan government said it was a straight-up war crime, and they were right, too. Edema's crew used methods that were medieval, like hanging guys upside down for hours, sometimes days, until their bodies just sort of gave out. Other prisoners said their heads were held underwater while Edema and his Afghans screamed questions they couldn't answer. Sleep deprivation was another favorite of theirs. They'd keep the lights on, blast music, and shake their prisoners awake every time they passed out. There were reports of starvation, too. Guys left without food or water for days in order to break their will. Jack, whose real name was Jonathan, denied everything in court, claiming he never burned anyone with cigarettes, poured boiling water on them, or pulled out their toenails to extract confessions. But the survivors told a different story. They talked about being shackled in stress positions and the constant threat of beatings, or worse, if they didn't confess. Jack and his boys weren't interrogating anyone. They were torturing people for fun. I remember hearing about the raid on his place from one of our intel guys. Afghan police found bloodstains, ropes, and hoods, stuff like that that looked like it belonged in a horror movie. The prisoners, some of whom were barely alive when they were found, told the court that Edema's crew treated them like animals, how that even taunted and laughed at them as they begged and screamed for mercy. Edema had the nerve to say that he was working for the Pentagon, but it was all lies. The U.S. military had taken just one single solitary detainee from him back in 2002 or 2003, and had held the guy for a month before realizing he was a nobody, and after that, they cut him off. He'd conned everyone, from Northern Alliance warlords to journalists, into thinking he was legit, and everyone had fallen for it, hook, line, and sinker. Sometimes I Think back to that raid that he tricked us into joining them on, and the dried body parts his Afghan showed us. I'm pretty sure that wasn't a one-off and Jakadima had encouraged it. And then I wondered how much more suffering he inflicted before he was caught. He was sentenced to 10 years in September of 2004, and I get a real sense of satisfaction when I hear that news. But it didn't erase the guilt of having worked with him, even if it was for just a couple of hours. He ran that house of horrors for literally years, ruined some people's lives, and then walked away with a pardon from President Karzai in 2007. I know he ended up dying of AIDS in Mexico in 2012, and while the circumstances surrounding his death are really shady, I know for certain he never fully paid for what he did. And it's things like that which make me wish I was a religious man. But if by some slim miracle there really is a place people like that are punished when they die, then I know he's going to get far worse down there than he ever dished out up here. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 9 p.m. EST, and there are super fun live streams on Sundays and Wednesday nights. If you got a story, be sure to submit them over at my email, letsreadsubmissions@gmail.com, and you might even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks for members of the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations. Look at it anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, microwave your twinks.